Despite all that, we're resilient and we try our best.
Israel always interferes in the Palestinian sports affairs. It denies entry of equipment needed for different sports. Palestinian athletes face arrest and travel bans when they have to participate in a tournament. Israeli suffocating blockade is destroying sports facilities in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have demonstrated a strong determination to stand up against occupation, blockade, and poverty. The young Palestinians have understood that this is their only hope to gain international support.
Despite the overwhelming odds that Palestinians endure in the Gaza Strip, a glimpse of hope shines through the most impoverished areas in defiance, telling the whole world that there is on this land whatever makes life worth living. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Cancer patients in Gaza staged a sit-in protest to condemn the Israeli blockade that has taken its toll on their lives. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before they even can access treatment. Hospitals in Gaza grapple with a severe shortage of medicines, particularly those vital for cancer patients. The journey to receive crucial life-saving medical care is fraught with numerous obstacles for cancer patients in Gaza. Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement have prevented Palestinian patients with serious illnesses from seeking urgent medical treatment beyond the blockaded territory.
Lack of medical equipment and Israeli obstacles are hurting cancer patients. Doctors here are tirelessly working to help us, but the resources are limited. I have throat cancer, and my treatment is not always available in Gaza. I call on all the people around the world to help alleviate our suffering.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer from acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment, experiencing a staggering 60% deficit rate. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to deteriorate further. Israeli authorities also impose a ban on the entry of medical devices and equipment into the Gaza Strip, further weakening the provision of health services to cancer patients.
The worst obstacle facing us is the lack of medicines, especially chemotherapy and radiation therapy supplies for cancer patients. The number of cancer patients in Gaza is very high, and with the current shortages, we can't treat all of them.
The health sector has been grappling with critical shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007.
Health officials are calling on the international community to help end the shortage of medicines in the besieged Gaza Strip and save the lives of Palestinian patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
For the first time in United States history, a former president now has a mugshot. Donald Trump has been arrested in Georgia and is being prosecuted under racketeering charges for allegedly trying to subvert the state's 2020 presidential election votes. 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still say President Joe Biden's election was not legitimate.
You should be able to challenge an election. I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election, and I should have every right to do that. As you know, you have many people that you've been watching over the years do the same thing, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Stacey Abrams or many others.
It's the fourth arrest for Trump in 5 months, even as Trump is running neck and neck with Biden in 2024 election polls. That has many accusing the ruling Democrats of election interference and of weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents, and of dangerously dividing the country.
Because it was dragged on for so many years, and it was really made into a theater, and Donald Trump was able to use this, ironically, to build his brand, to build this this lie that the election was stolen, and really... really just brainwashed millions of people, you know, into continuing to support him. I think it really spells disaster for the unity of the ruling class.
Trump's popularity among Republicans has soared since the first indictment, and he seems certain to be their candidate next year. Polls show the nation is almost perfectly split regarding Trump's 4 court cases and 91 felony charges. While a part of the United States has become galvanized both for and against Trump, for decades the United States has been defined by political apathy, low voter turnout rates, and disinterest in Washington politics seen as so corrupt, it's routinely referred to as the swamp.
It seems like a lot of work, and typically I feel like people that high up don't really ever get convicted of anything, so it might be a lot of time and money and effort going towards nothing at the end, so I don't know.
The 2024 presidential campaign began this week with the first Republican Party primary debate, but the focus was on Donald Trump, and the focus will likely remain on Trump for at least the next 15 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU statistical agency Eurostat's latest report on business registrations and bankruptcies leaves little room for interpretation. Small and medium businesses across the old continent are struggling amid the unprecedented challenges posed by some global events such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the energy crisis, high levels of inflation and high interest rates. Bankruptcy declarations in the European Union reached the highest level since 2015 in the second quarter of this year. The number of closures in the April-June period was 8% higher than the previous quarter, marking a sixth consecutive increase. Hungary, Latvia and Estonia have recorded the highest number of enterprises declaring bankrupt in 2023.
It is important to stress that Eastern European countries benefited enormously from delocalization over the past two decades. Today, the enduring effects of the many crises are also evident on the Eastern Europe.
A sharp increase in the number of bankruptcy declarations has been recorded in the accommodation and food services sectors across the whole old continent. Registrations of new businesses are declining. The clock is ticking in Italy as well. The Confederation of Italian Enterprises, Confindustria, has reported that about 120,000 companies in Italy are facing bankruptcy and as many as 370,000 jobs are at stake. Soaring gas and energy prices, high inflation and the rising cost of borrowing money have worsened an already difficult situation. For over 15 years, the exit rate of companies in the country has been much higher than the entry rate. According to the authoritative agency Cerved, hundreds of thousands of companies have closed and millions of jobs have gone wasted since 2008. Cerved estimates that about 3 million workers risk losing their jobs in the coming months.
In his maiden speech to the Upper House in 2021, former Prime Minister Mario Draghi pointed out that a new selective industrial policy discussed by the members of the G30 was needed to limit the rising number of the so-called zombie companies, those firms unable to pay their long-term debts. It goes without saying that Italy's workers and small and medium-sized enterprises, which account for the vast majority of Italian firms, are bearing the brunt of this policy.
Our Western economic systems are connected like communicating vessels. In my view, things will get worse as the vessels are connected too tightly.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine and the curtailment of Russian pipeline gas supplies to Europe, companies in energy-intensive sectors have been the most affected. Max Civili, Rome.
South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders.
If the large-scale military exercises of South Korea and the U.S. continue, North Korea will respond with provocations. And then strategic assets, such as fighter bombers of the U.S. forces, will be engaged, and the vicious cycle carries on. At this rate, these military exercises will expand further and become regular. So, of course, the tension on the Korean Peninsula will increase.
The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies.
Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Change in the world can come if nations function on the principle of mutual cooperation and respect. But the imperative is to break free from the status quo, and BRICS leaders have a number of proposals they want implemented to realize this. Among the most urgent being accelerating de-dollarization, establishing a common currency, and countering Western-imposed sanctions.
Through the new development bank, we can offer our own alternatives for the adequate financing that will attend to the needs of the global south. Through the help of my sister Dilma Rousseff, the bank will manage to face the challenges, the creation of a common vetted unit for our trade transactions and investments for BRICS countries will increase payment options and reduce our vulnerabilities.
With an increasing number of countries wanting to join BRICS, the group presents prospects of prosperity, cooperation and development. As the sessions were underway here, India successfully landed its Chandrayaan-3 mission on the moon. And this is the type of expertise and know-how that can hopefully be shared through a mechanism such as BRICS.
Through initiatives such as the BRICS Satellite Constellation, the Vaccine R&D Center, mutual recognition of pharma products, we are bringing about positive changes in the lives of ordinary citizens in BRICS countries. Through initiatives such as the Youth Summit, BRICS Games, the Think Tanks Council, we are strengthening people-to-people ties in all countries.
The West's reliance on sanctions has inadvertently strengthened those it wanted to isolate. Russia highlighted how sanctions have hampered the international economic system. And even with traditional allies of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia, knocking at BRICS's door, change looks very much possible. BRICS now stands on the threshold of becoming a far more influential body, one which will shape a new world order and present a true challenge to the West's stranglehold. The final day of deliberations, which will look at expansion, will decide its future. Hassan Siriyap, Santon.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed. Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khanduzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khanduzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
On almost every commercial street in the Belgian capital, there is evidence of failed businesses. The country's statistics office recorded 1,092 bankruptcies in June alone. Bridi Said has been in business for 30 years. He says things have never been so tough.
Difficult to find the rent. Rent is expensive and a lot of things together. And the war, sure, and the war.
Across the 27 countries that make up the EU, bankruptcies increased by 8% in April, May and June compared to the previous 3 months. That's according to Eurostat, the bloc's statistical office, which says the increases are at their highest since it began collating such data in 2015. We've raised the issue with the European Commission.
What are the EU authorities doing to try and support these firms under pressure?
The answer was, we'll get back to you with a response. Many analysts say high inflation and rising interest rates are happening in the EU because sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. The bloc is sending deadly weapons worth billions of euro to Ukraine amid growing calls for peace talks. This is a subject we also asked the bloc's executive arm about.
Is there a realisation within the EU that, you know, this current war as it stands, it's unwinnable?
Hopefully they will win. Hopefully they will win soon. We are supporting Ukraine. We will support Ukraine for as long as it gets. Of course we want to see peace, but the peace needs to be on Ukrainian terms.
The EU released a further 1.5 billion euro to the Ukrainian government on Tuesday. Back home, the social crisis is deepening and millions are struggling to pay their mortgages due to interest rate hikes. The knock-on effect of bankruptcies could be disastrous. Experts warn. If unemployment rises sharply, which many business insiders say now seems inevitable, extra pressure will be placed on already strained social welfare systems. An unprecedented economic crisis could be in store for the EU. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
According to the Citizens Advice Bureau, a record number of people in the United Kingdom are heading into the winter with energy debts as they borrow to pay their bills. The charity Citizens Advice urged the government to step in with fresh support for gas and electricity bills. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Britain's Sun newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Millions of British households still face higher energy bills this winter despite a predicted fall in Ofgem's price cap. According to the Resolution Foundation, this includes almost half of those in the poorest tenth of British households. Forecasts by Cornwall Insight predict that typical bills will fall to around £1,925 a year. It is a reduction of 7% compared to the July price cap and the lowest it has been since March of 2022. Before July, typical energy bills were capped at £2,500 a year, but millions received a £400 energy discount, which reduced this rate to £2,100 a year. But the headline reduction in bills by almost £200 in October still masks wide variation for British households. Although the price per unit of energy is falling, this will be offset by a rise in the daily standing charge and the fact that last winter's universal £400 energy bill discount is not being repeated. As a result, the biggest falls in bills will be seen by households who use the most energy, while households who consume relatively little energy will face higher energy bills this winter than last year. The Resolution Foundation calculates that households that consume less than four-fifths or 79% of typical gas and electricity consumption will see higher bills this winter. These additional costs will often be significant. Around 1 in 8 British households, or 13%, equivalent to 2.7 million households, will see winter energy bills increase by as much as £100 or more this year. Jonathan Marshall, senior economist at the Resolution Foundation, said Ofgem is set to announce that the typical household energy bill will fall this winter, but more than 1 in 3 households across England will be shocked to discover that their energy bills could actually be higher this winter than last winter. He added, this increase will be particularly acute for England's poorest families, a quarter of whom will spend at least £100 more on energy bills this winter compared to last year. He added, with these energy bill increases coming up on top of a prolonged period of fast-rising food and housing costs, the cost of living squeeze is far from over. Cornwall Insights forecast sees bills rising again slightly in the future. In the first 3 months of next year, analysts think that the electricity prices will be 29.4 pence and gas prices will be 7.7 pence, adding around £150 to the average annual bill. Dr. Craig Lowry, principal consultant at Cornwall Insights, said, while a small decrease in October's bills is to be welcomed, we once again see energy price forecasts far above pre-crisis levels, underscoring the limitations of the price cap as a tool for supporting households with their energy bills. Dr. Craig Lowry said, as many, including energy regulator Ofgem, have acknowledged, it is essential that the government explore alternative solutions that are social tariffs to ensure stability and affordability for consumers. He added, looking ahead to next year, we see how events on the other side of the globe have impacted gas prices and our subsequent price cap predictions. Dr. Craig Lowry said, in the same way as we saw wholesale market volatility impact our price forecast last year, similar developments risk causing sharp changes in household bills in 2024. Adding, the UK's structural reliance on gas imports means that it is highly susceptible to fluctuations in the international wholesale energy markets. Millions are also in line to receive cost of living payments worth up to £1,350. The first instalment of £900 payment has been paid to millions of people on certain benefits, including universal credit and pension credit. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Citizens Advice Bureau said a record number of people in the United Kingdom are heading into the winter with energy debt as they borrow to pay their bills, as it urged the government to step in with fresh support for gas and electricity bills. The charity, Citizens Advice, says 2023 has been its busiest year, with a number of people struggling with debt and the amount of money they owe at record levels and rising. It has suggested the government consider offering more support this winter. More than 46,400 people asked Citizens Advice for support in the first 6 months of this year, marking a 17% rise compared to the same period last year. On average, those contacting the charity had about £1,700 worth of unpaid energy bills, with analysis showing disabled people and families with young children were the most likely to be struggling with high levels of debt. The sector regulator Ofgem recently estimated that the collective gas and electricity debt owed by British consumers was about £2.3 billion. Nearly 8 million people had to borrow money to pay their energy bills. Ofgem will announce a new energy price cap, which forecasters have predicted will keep the typical annual household bill at the equivalent of about £1,823 from October, although much of that change will be the result of a new formula that assumes lower gas and electricity prices. Under the current formula, the cap will be equivalent to £1,925. However, that cap level will still mean about 29 million homes in England, Wales and Scotland that it applies to are paying roughly 40% more than they were 2 years ago, before supplies were disrupted after Russia's special operation in Ukraine. With households not entitled to the £400 support they received last winter split into monthly payments between October and April, Citizens Advice Bureau warned that millions of people were facing a winter as bad as last winter or even worse. The charity predicts that by the end of this year, it will have seen 26% more people in need of help with their energy debt payments compared with 2022. It says the number of people already seeking support had nearly doubled in the past 4 years. Struggling households unable to pay their energy bills, people unable to top up their prepayment meter, and record numbers coming to us for crisis support. Claire Moriarty added, with increasing numbers of people we help facing a negative budget where they simply don't have enough money to cover their essential bills. There is a real risk this winter will be worse than last year.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. I'm Nazia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it has been 60 years since renowned civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech during the March on Washington. A quarter of a million people, most of them black, showed up for that historic rally. They were demanding equality for black Americans. Now, Dr. King said that the U.S. had given black people a promissory note, which it had defaulted on, and now it was time for America to cash that equality check. How close are black Americans today to Dr. King's dream. Well, stay with us on this spotlight as we take a look at this. I'd like to introduce my guests to you all. Joseph Richardson, professor of African American Studies and Anthropology, University of Maryland, out of Laurel, Maryland. And Frank Imspach, radio producer and political commentator, out of Madison. Thank you both for being with me.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me start it off in Maryland. And Joseph, how would you compare the situation of African Americans today to 60 years ago?
I would say that not much has changed, particularly in terms of the racial wealth gap in the United States and what we have seen and what Dr. King was primarily advocating for, particularly during the last days of his life, and even at the speech for where he had the I Had a Dream, advocating for economic equality as well as racial equality. And what we're seeing right now in terms of the racial wealth gap in the United States, that whites have a net worth of 10 times more than Black Americans. And if you just want to put it in context of the real numbers, it's $171,000 of net worth for white households compared to $17,000 for Black households. I'll just give you another statistic. The 400 richest American billionaires have a total wealth more than the 10 million Black American households combined. And so what we were seeing with Dr. King when he was asking for that check, we have not seen that closure in the racial wealth gap since the 1960s.
Well, Frank, on the same day as the 60th anniversary of that March on Washington, we saw that there was a hate crime committed against Black Americans in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, let's talk about, there seems to be an increase in hate violence in general in the United States, and especially against Black Americans. Your take on that. First of all, do you agree with that? And if you do, what's going on? What's happening?
Well, I agree with it. And I think what you've had here, first of all, I agree also with the first speaker. The Economic Policy Institute has just come out with a study comparing everything over the last 60 years. And remember, that was a March for Jobs and Freedom. Mm-hmm. That was the official title of the march. And the percentage of wealth of Black families compared to white families has pretty much been stagnant over the 60 years. It's dropped a little bit in the last three or four. That's the first part. But the second thing is, yes, I think we're seeing an increase in a culture of violence. You have the governor of Florida passing legislation, doing things saying you can't even discuss racism in the schools. You have, as a result of that, a culture where the kind of racism and, white supremacy that came about after Reconstruction that had been challenged in the historical narrative is now being attacked in and of itself. You can't teach about it. And so in a sense, that justifies it. So that's one thing that's happening. You have an ex-president of the United States who basically cast his campaign in a racist way, sort of giving permission for people to speak out. And so you're going to have the people coming out of the woodwork here. But you've also had, over many years now, this constant drumbeat that of black criminality, of disintegration of the cities. And it's basically the message that many people get is that it's people of color, it's their fault. And so sooner or later, you're going to have people who act on those very deep racist sentiments. And that's what we're seeing.
Mm. Well, Joseph, what about that? You heard Frank said that people react on this alleged criminality, that it's their fault that all of this is happening. And we know the old saying of pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and that black Americans never really did that. I want to talk about how can it be that in 2023 we are still here? I mean, is it that the U.S. government did not do enough to address this issue? What is the core issue? What is the problem here, Joseph?
I mean, we've seen the success of black Americans following the Civil War, where we had the greatest narrowing of the racial wealth gap at that time following the Civil War between black Americans and white Americans. And then after that time, due to racial oppression and systematic racism and all of the laws we know that have undergird the success of black Americans, we saw a retrenching and a regression in those strides that we made following the Civil War. And so up to this point, we have had laws in place, as the other speaker mentioned, in terms of what we see in Florida with the reversal of teaching critical race theory in classrooms, and also other laws that have become quite regressive and detrimental and draconian to Black Americans. And so I think that we live in a land of systematic racism. We live in a land of structural violence, and we're not willing to address all of the ugly deeds and ugly flaws of the American government and how they've been perpetuated against Black Americans since our arrival on the shores of this country. And right now, what we are seeing and what we have seen is an increase not only in the racial wealth gap, but we've seen increases in unemployment. Particularly in my hometown and in Washington, D.C., which has a recent study found that we have the largest racial unemployment gap in the nation. This is in the nation's capital. So we're using the nation's capital as a barometer for where Black Americans are. Then white Washingtonians are 7 times more likely to be employed than Black Washingtonians. We have a life expectancy in the southeast side of the city, which is east of the river, which is predominantly black. In many neighborhoods, the life expectancy reaches 69 years, where if you travel 15 to 20 minutes away in the northwest section of the city near the National Zoo, the life expectancy in that neighborhood, which is predominantly white and affluent, is 89 years. And so all of these things combine and lead to forms of structural racism that result in shorter life expectancy, less wealth accumulated over time. And as Dr. Sandy Darity, economist at Duke, noted, is that the individual responsibilities that will be placed on Black Americans to close these racial, economic, and health gaps will not be done individually. It has to be done by the government. And unfortunately, we have not seen the government take any strides towards closing those gaps.
Yeah, that's absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, Frank, we talked about the violence, increase in violence in general, but we also have one of the things that Dr. King actually talked about even then was police violence. And we see that this continues to be a major issue. Black Americans, especially black males, a lot of times they take their life in their own hands by just driving around town sometimes. I mean, let's talk about that aspect and what does that do to the psyche of these individuals? I mean, Joseph talked about the economic difference and the pressure, and we're talking about 20 years difference in lifespan in the same city. I mean, I want to talk about that, the police violence and the threat that always is over the heads of these individuals.
Well, I just want to say one thing about what the prior speaker said. It isn't so much what the government can do for you, it's what the government has done to prevent you. And my example, and because we're talking about Washington a minute ago, was Woodrow Wilson, you know, the great Democrat who segregated the Postal Service and removed black supervisors over whites and segregated the Federal Service in 1912 or so. And so it isn't just a passive thing here. You've had the intervention of the government to oppose racial equality, oppose upward economic mobility by refusing to allow the GI Bill loans for homes, which is the biggest wealth increase in this country. That's where they come from, homes. Prevented black veterans after World War II from getting those loans. Now, what does that mean? It means that when you start talking about the police, you're now dealing with segregated neighborhoods and a segregated and almost all white police force, but operating on the principle that somehow or other young black men are the criminals. And you see this in a town like Madison, which is almost all white. But what is the big crime here? It's driving while black on East Washington Avenue, which is a street about four blocks in back of this house, where for years there was this phenomenal racial disparity in the arrests for people driving, black people driving. So they got arrested four or five times the number of white drivers. Now, how does this happen? All of a sudden, the black kids are driving faster? It's just nonsense. It's a racist perception. And I think that that's how the police forces operate. My experience personally as an activist, unfortunately, is that I think there are, you know, like two police forces here. And a whole world goes on that people, that white people do not see, of the police acting in an aggressive, hostile manner towards black people. And I think it comes from the whole, really from the slavery times, when the police were really set up, particularly in the South, but also in the North, to go after black people, to go after fugitive slaves. So this whole thing for over 100 years has been going on. And I don't think that there is any substantive opposition to that politically. You have the Black Lives Matter, but they were unable to put institutionally in place meaningful opposition and a different system of policing here. Every one of them has been defeated. And now you have the Republicans going after progressive attorneys generals who have been elected and removing them from office, as you did with Governor DeSantis in Florida. He got rid of two people, said, well, I'm governor, you're through, even though they were elected by their community in large part, to deal with the police. One of the aspects being, of course, cash bail. All these mm-hmm. systems, you know, go after people, and particularly people of color.
Right. Well, Joseph, Frank talked about, he's basically said that not that the government could not do anything, but the government is also at fault. I want to go back to 1865, really, prior to that, when the U.S. government actually promised then former slaves that they would get 40 acres and a mule. And after President Abraham Lincoln's assassination, this was canceled. And it was never followed through. How is it that black Americans were never compensated? Not that they could ever truly be compensated for what has taken place, but at least somewhat on an economic perspective, how come that has never taken place?
I mean, I think we're going in a conversation of just being redundant. And I opened with the remarks in terms of what was said regarding what the government has not done. I opened with using the concept of structural violence, which means that the government structure has been violent primarily to specific racial groups. And in this context, that means African-Americans in forms of social murder. And so when we understand exactly what those policies have done to the life expectancy of African-Americans in terms of their health, in terms of their wealth, in terms of racial equality, these are all forms of violence. And so I don't want to go down on the road of thinking or talking specifically about gun violence. We know that violence comes in all different ways, shapes, and forms. Not only does it come through police brutality and the killing of Black, disproportionate killing of Black Americans, it also comes through housing policy. It also comes through historical erasure and treating Black Americans as if we're invisible. So these are all forms of violence, and I want to just uplift and make sure that we acknowledge that structural violence is behind all of this, mm-hmm. and has been since the very beginning. And so to say that what the government hasn't done, we need to call it for what it is. The government has been violent both physically, and the government has been violent both psychologically and structurally to Black Americans. So in terms of why we have never had racial equality in this country. This country is built on racial capitalism. So I wouldn't have the expectation at all that there would be a form of racial equality in this country based on that the wealth of this country was built on racial capitalism. So it would be almost impossible against the ideology and principles of capitalism to close that gap. So I don't foresee that happening in this country unless we have a real revolution economically. And that revolution will require reparations. But I don't think in any time soon that white Americans are honest enough, and I won't blame it just on the structure. I will also blame it on the lack of advocacy by many white Americans who are complicit through their silence of allowing these things to happen. Because only African Americans through this country have been the beacons of the consciousness of bringing these issues to the forefront. And so it's not just about whether the government and what they have done to us or not have done to us, but how are we going to resolve these issues?
Right.
And the one way that we can get to the resolution, the quickest way, is not through policy, because we know policy is slow to change. But one way we can do is by closing the economic gap in this country. And the way that we can do that, as has been done with other groups in this country, is by providing reparations to Black Americans who rightfully and warrant the reparations that are owed to them based mm-hmm. on the free labor that has been provided and then all of the social atrocities that have occurred since our arrival on these shores.
Well, what about that, Frank? I mean, there have been many groups who get reparations in the United States. And I mean, for 350 years, Blacks worked to build the United States for free and continue to be discriminated against, and violence, of course, invoked against them. I mean, why haven't we seen these reparations? And are we likely to see them now? What we saw after George Floyd and the movement and taking off and Black Lives Matter. So if Black Lives really matter, then why is there such an economic gap? When is that going to be addressed?
Well, Black Lives may matter, but they don't matter to a lot of people, and they don't matter to a majority of white people in reality, I think. I think that there's such a cultural depth to racism in this country. Here's just one example. We talk about reparations, and of course, that's a non-starter politically. White people say, why should we pay these people? They don't know. We don't owe them anything. Look at all the things we have done, right? That's the answer. So what have we done? The largest daily, weekly, monthly payment to white people is in the mortgage tax deduction system here. You get a huge tax deduction when you pay, you have a mortgage. Your interest is deducted. Well, who gets that, right? So the whole home ownership thing, where whites were already subsidized, right? You get another subsidy. Well, most white people don't see it that way. You know, that's theirs. So why shouldn't they have it? And you mean we're going to give that kind of same thing to black people? We're going to give a rent reduction or something like that? What, are you crazy? That's the response. And it, what it does is it reinforces all of the social inequalities, racial inequalities, housing, and everything. But if you talk to the average white person, they do not see that. They see that slavery was over. That's 100 years ago. It wasn't my problem. And that's it. And so the kind of aggressive change culturally and politically you're going to have here is immense. But until we are able to really build that movement, I don't see reparations or any other fundamental thing moving forward. And that is the great sort of original sin here. If you build a society on slavery and the appropriation of indigenous land and kill, you know, 6 or 7 million people, you know that chickens are coming home to roost. And I think Malcolm X was right about that. The whole flock is coming home now because every single aspect of our society here is under stress and is getting worse. The inequalities are worse. The repression is worse. The militarization of the police is a step backwards. The transformation, a brilliant transformation on the part of, I think, the ruling class from civil rights to crime in the streets, which happened in 1968, 69, 70. And all of a sudden, this tremendous movement led by black people with white support was suddenly transformed into this urban crisis where the cities are being decapitalized, torn apart, and where the fundamental employment structure of black people in steel and in the railroads and everything else was basically decimated. And then the black population is blamed for this. So this is a tremendous thing that happened here, sort of a second reconstruction in a way, where, in fact, a social movement was completely derailed. And I think that all these things are coming together, but most white people do not see any of this or much of it.
Joseph, your perspective, what is it going to take to bring about real equality? You know, image-wise, there are those who started talking about former President Obama, that was a major advancement for black people, or the current vice president who is half black. First of all, about that reality, what does that actually mean for the average black American anyway? But what is it going to take, in your perspective, to really turn this around?
Well, we know through studies, and I want to reference economist Dr. Sandy Darity, who's done an amazing study on the racial wealth gap in America and how we can arrive at solutions. One of the things that Dr. Darity uplifts in his analysis is that we cannot educate our way out of it. So even if we were to provide African Americans with a free college education, which I would definitely support, and I definitely support removing student loan debt. But even if we were to offer those as an incentive to ameliorate many of the racial problems and racial inequality issues that we've seen, it still would not close the racial wealth gap in the United States. So again, although I think that there are many white Americans, and I know that there are many white Americans who would disagree with reparations as a form to solve many of these issues, it's really the federal government and the responsibility of the federal government to take over this situation. I don't mean it in from a state or a local level, but for federal reparations to happen. And you mentioned in the outset in one of your questions in terms of land, but we know that the United States has captured much of the land that was owned by African Americans and